Welcome to the Wednesday Rant. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me one more time. We got a lot of ground to cover today, no pun intended. As if there needed to be a pun. Even if there was one, it wasn't intended. Anyway, big news here in Chicago. The alligator that was terrorizing Humboldt Park has been caught. I want to talk a little bit about the 50 years since the moon landing, a half a century since one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Got to get into Newton's third law today. The first two laws, yeah, they're okay, but that third law means everything. Over the weekend, I was at a Earth Forum. And if you're a regular or even an irregular listener to this podcast, you know we run the Earth Matters with Bill Curtis series almost every episode. You'll hear one in this program today for sure, something that I created and researched and produced and Bill did the voice work for. And I got some thoughts about that. And of course, because it's a podcast, got to talk about stuff. One of my favorite books has been hovering on my desk here in the vaunted Life 2.0 podcast studios. It's called As a Man Thinketh. That ties into everything that I want to get to today. And I also want to talk about why I keep a dead cicada in my office. So let's get on with it. Up the down staircase in the outdoor. Dig for the obvious, buried in the absurd. Try to make some sense out of the senseless. Today it's the Wednesday Rant, the whole kit and caboodle. Let's get to it. Well, it's been a little while since I did a true Wednesday rant. I try to be as zen-like as I possibly can, not for your benefit so much, but for mine, for my blood pressure, which is actually 122 over 75, so I'm doing okay with that. But the reason I try to pull back on a lot of this stuff is because, you know, for the most part, and I say this all the time, and I repeat this for my own benefit as well as yours, hopefully, that, you know, spending time in things that I can't control is not good for me. Getting my undies in a bundle, you know, get the wrench snapped off, all the rest of it, it just elevates the blood pressure. Then you got to take medication, you got to do meditation, you got to take more recreation, all kind of shins go along with that. So I try to the best of my abilities, watch what's going on in the world and only engage in things that I think I can have some modicum of involvement with, because most of it I can't. Neither can you, sad to say. But that's really what the world in so many ways is invested in. It's throwing a bunch of stuff against the wall that you can't do anything about. Having an opinion about those things, for better or for worse, you know, like I do on this every time. And then have some sort of angst one way or the other about what's going on. So it's all about balance to me. As they've said many, many times, it's not what you're eating that's the problem, but it's what's eating you is the real problem. And so much eats at us these days. Matter of fact, Chicago was a little concerned for the last 9 days because somebody put an alligator in Humboldt Park and people were worried, you know, that someone's going to get eaten. It was a 4 or 5 foot long alligator. And the absurdity part of this comes from the media, which of course went bonkers. To some degree, I was okay with that. I mean, you know, most of the headlines here in Chicago are filled with the dead and the dread, bottom line, and all that's going wrong. And so when this alligator showed up in Humboldt Park, he was named Chance the Snapper after Chance the Rapper. I don't know how that happened, but he was spotted in the lagoon. And of course, you know, that was all it took. You know, every news outlet was here. They were coming in from other countries. They wanted to see the alligator. People were parking places they'd never park. Let me tell you what, even though Humboldt Park has been cleaned up quite a bit since back in the day, it is not somewhere you want to get caught very late at night. So there's an alligator in the Humboldt Park Lagoon, and it evaded capture for 9 days. Yeah, Alligator Bob they brought in. And he was setting traps everywhere, and that didn't work. And, you know, for my purposes, I thought this isn't a bad thing. You know, they just had a huge tax increase here in Illinois. And, you know, gas went up 19 cents a gallon because of the tax increase. And I thought, why don't they just start selling tickets to offset some of those costs, you know? I mean, you could start selling ice cream, put up some bleachers. People could have a watch for Chance the Snapper. I preferred the old Alligator name, but I digress. So anyway, the long and short of it is it's been bug house here because there's an alligator in the Humboldt Park Lagoon. But the absurd part, as I mentioned a couple seconds ago, is the media shows up and they determined, hang on to your hats, kids, they determined that the alligator was put there by somebody. Like he was somebody's pet and kind of outgrew his terrarium and somebody put him in the lagoon. Really? He's not indigenous to Chicago? I mean, when you watch someone on the news who's very well dressed and being all professional, holding a microphone when their hair is well coiffed and they're standing next to the lagoon, it's in the background and people are watching, and this is primetime news, and with a deadpan face says, it appears that the alligator was put into the lagoon, was probably somebody's pet, and was dumped here. The investigation continues. And everybody else is going, are you kidding me? Really? You needed expert testimony for that? Did you guys figure that part out yourself? Anyway, he was caught overnight. And it was nice to see a reptile in Chicago that's not a politician. So can I just say that part of it? And some of the other things that come to mind with all this, and it ties into this event that I went to this past weekend at a college here in Chicago that was an environmental forum, is that, you know, obviously, I mean, there may have been a time back in the Jurassic Park, Paleozoic, Mesozoic, who knows what era, that there were crocodiles and alligators in the Chicago area when this was a lowland sea and had abundance of swimming things that were like dinosaurs. But obviously, they're not indigenous to Chicago at this point. So to see this reptile in there and see everybody get all worked up about it and how they're going to catch him, and, you know, they spend all this money and they get all the experts, and the fact that the alligator still was able to survive for 9 days, I loved it. And it was a big part of what I saw this weekend at this environmental conference. And here's kind of how that plays out for me. One of the greatest challenges, in my observation, opinion, and experience, that we face as a species is that we think we're the only species that matter. Because we have all this technology, right? I mean, there's cell phones and all this stuff that makes us so cool and great and wonderful. You can't get people of 4 different ethnicities to sit down at the table and agree on much. But, you know, we got all this technology, so we're the best. And we all like to run around and put down the big foam number one fingers and all that kind of stuff. But the fact of the matter is we're not. We're not the only species on the planet. And even when we act like we're the only species on the planet, we turns out we're at the whim and mercy of nature. So as the storms are pounding this past week in New Orleans and other parts of Louisiana, and the storm actually today in Chicago that came through the Gulf is making its way up here, and the weather patterns are shifting, and, you know, there's an old, very old, because Voltaire said it, like, I don't know, 200 years ago, you know, men argue and nature acts. And there was a show on television not long ago, it's like After Man or After Humans or something, to show how nature will simply swallow up everything we've built. So we really hang, in my opinion, on the precipice every single day of one catastrophe away, an environmental 9/11, in my opinion, that shows us we're going to get our ass handed to us in some way, shape, or form. So all it takes is a brownout or a blackout, depending on how you look at it, in New York, and everybody goes nuts. I mean, you turn the power off on people, it gets their attention. Now what are we going to do? What are we going to do now? So these creature comforts that we have turned us into creatures. I'm just not really sure what kind and how resourceful we can be at times. So I'm at this environmental conference, and I went there for a couple of reasons, probably 8 reasons, actually. And I wanted to see how it compared to the information that Bill Curtis and I do on our Earth Matters events. Number one, quite frankly, I want to see what they had to offer. And it was 1, 2, 3 congressmen, a meteorologist, a research scientist, and an activist, environmental activist. So I'm not a congressperson, and I'm certainly, no one's going to ever mistake me for a scientist or a meteorologist or a climatologist. I'm just a guy who grew up in the city, spent a lot of time outside. I've spent a fair amount of time out west and other places around the world where you get a chance to experience Earth, you know, away from computer screens and all the cool little videos we have and stuff, that you really have a tactile connection to the planet. My degree, actually, I actually have one, is in environmental interpretation and communication. And I seem to have this innate ability to take things that seem very difficult and overwhelming and a lot of information and kind of crunch those down. And that's exactly what I did with the Earth Matters 1 minute radio spots that Bill and I have produced. To take volumes of information and break it down into 59 seconds so somebody can make an informed decision is like, I get a kick out of that. I've been doing it a long time. So I'm watching the forum, want to see what they had to say. They had it slated for 4 hours. And I thought, well, that first off, as much as I'm interested, I'm done after about 90 minutes. I'm going to check out. But I give them an A for effort. Let me just say that up front. The place was packed. The auditorium was very well attended. I think one of the reasons, and I could say it here because we've run this guy, I have to find it, is the Earth Matters with the vaunted meteorologist Tom Skilling, who, much like Bill Curtis, is an icon in Chicago and around the world, really, as far as his predictions and what he does. He's been doing this a long time. Very smart guy, very passionate about climate and weather and all that goes on, and fascinated by his passion, really, that drives him decades of doing this work. And one of the points that I've made about Tom's work is that if you're going to sit and, you know, trust this guy for the weather locally, which everybody does in Chicago, 9 million people, you know, he's the guy, then we need to really consider trusting his intuition and his scientific deductions on climate change. Can't just say he's okay over here, but I don't agree with him over here, because I think then you lose that piece. So Tom was center stage there. Senator Dick Durbin was there. Again, give him all an A for effort for standing up and coming on a Saturday and be willing to come out and talk and do these things. And then they lost me. And I'm a tough guy to lose because I'm in on it. And what I heard outside of Tom, who was very scientifically based and really gave us volumes of information about what's going on, and here's this, and here's how it stacks up for the last 180 years, all valuable information. But once I have that information, I have to have something, you know, to do with it. Where can I park this? Just listen, knowledge is only potential power. It's not real power unless you can apply it. Just to know a lot of stuff, that's not hard anymore these days. I'll Google it, you know it, you're done. But where do you apply these things? So Tom gave a fantastic, very comprehensive, very in-depth crash course on climate science. And it was impressive, of course, as all get out. Senator Durbin talked a little bit about the work he's done and what needs to be done from a policy level. And that's important. The two other congressmen, one has been a physicist and the other gentleman was a scientist as well. And they came from those backgrounds. And that's important. But the problem is, in my observation, was that there's no human element. I kept telling T, I said, where's the human element? This is like sitting in probably third year earth science, which is fine, but everybody in the room's kind of like, okay, so what do we do? What action can I take? And then it eventually turned around to a great degree valid about our current president and the administration, the steps they weren't taking, the things that were being rolled back, and how all that was working out and the devastating effect that has. All true. But that didn't help me become an advocate for change. It just confirmed people were applauding and all that. And so I'm thinking, so if we're here to make sure that all of you get reelected, then that's a different experience. I came to this and I need to know what I can do right where I'm at to make a difference. Because otherwise I'm just, and voting is highly important. But you have like 230 days before you can do that. So between now and then, you're just going to complain until you can make a vote. And if it doesn't go the way you want, then what are you going to do? So it was interesting to me that the most important element that has caused the most problem on the planet, humans, was not addressed in a way like, here's 17 things you can leave with today. Go home and do one of these. And that little one action at least puts you in the solution stream of things and not just sitting back doing the woulda, coulda, shoulda dance. So after 90 minutes, almost 2 hours, it was time to bug out. They were going to get to questions and answers. And when we walked into the auditorium, beautiful place, wonderful, saw a couple of performers there, very nice. We both noticed that at every chair next to the name tags, there were plastic water bottles at the environmental forum. If there was one scourge of the planet, if there was one thing that is swallowing us, there's a lot, but if we can just pick one, it would be the amount of plastic we generate. And we both looked at us, each other went, really? Are you kidding me? We're at an environmental conference and there's plastic bottles out. Now, look, I get it. I mean, I do. It's become part of who we are and what we do and how it is. And the biggest scam ever perpetrated on humanity was like, oh, so 92% of you have clean drinking water in the world, but you need this stuff in a bottle because it's even cleaner. And here's how much it's going to cost. And when it's on sale, you'll really start buying it. So unless you live like in Flint, Michigan, where you can't get clean water, or some third world country that you got to walk 7 miles one way to get, you know, the clay urn filled, we don't need bottled water. When I was a kid, here we go. When I was a kid growing up, there was no such thing. You want a bottle of water? You took a Coke bottle, you rinsed it out, you filled it up with water, and you drank it. End of story. We drank right from the spigot in the kitchen. Yeah, I know, living on the edge. This morning, I went out and watered, and I took the end of the hose off and drank water that went through the hose. So to see the water bottles that are sitting on the environmental forum stage was a little bit like, folks, it's those kind of conscious decisions, little things that turn out to be big things. So I only saw one of the participants use the water bottle. T actually put the question in. Why are you using water bottles? We left before a chance to see. I don't think they ever would have picked that question because they would have jumped over it. And that in itself is a thing. Whether they did or didn't, we weren't there to hear it. If they did, everybody probably laughed and said, yeah, we screwed up. If they didn't, then that right there is like, we need to rethink things. And is not everything about rethinking something? So for those of us of a certain vintage that can remember a time before water bottles, they seem absurd to me. It's an absurdity. And for those who don't know about that time, it's just absolutely, what are you talking about? You just drink water out of a bottle and then you throw the bottle away. We were down at Starved Rock State Park for a hike before it got really hot here a week ago. And we were at a place called Lake Matheson. Beautiful river there, and there's a lake and the whole deal, and we sat around. And for the most part, it was pretty clean. But on the hike back, I picked up 3 or 4 water bottles. Some still had water in them. Somebody tossed in a state park. And I'm thinking, it's that kind of consciousness that's the problem. And how do you change that consciousness? You know, Jacques Cousteau said, you protect what you love. And I'd like to think that most people understand that we have this, you know, vital connection to the planet and the life support systems that keep us alive. But until somebody pinches the oxygen hose, we don't get it. So anyway, that's kind of how that environmental thing went. And on that, let's just run the Earth Matters right now.
He might just be the most trusted weatherman in the business. Millions rely on his predictions, and he has a lot to say about climate change. As the chief meteorologist for WGN in Chicago and across America for the past 37 years, Tom Skilling has been studying weather patterns. And when it comes to climate change, he says our planet is on a record-shattering streak. Atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide are now over 400 parts per million. This is the first time in more than 800,000 years that there has been this much carbon in the atmosphere. When baseball got out of whack, congressional hearings led to modifications to America's national pastime. However, it's become apparent that Congress is not inclined to act on stemming the pollution that leads to the extreme weather-causing climate change that we're experiencing. If we trust him for the everyday weather, maybe we should pay close attention to his long-term forecast as well. I'm Bill Curtis for Earth Matters.
We like to cherry pick. in life. If it fits our confirmation bias, we're all in. If it doesn't, we're all out. That's a lot of what goes on in politics, always has, probably always will. I don't ever see humans get to a point where we start to do kumbaya all together. We're heading towards 8 billion people. The resources are getting more scarce. And when it affects us in our own backyard, we go, hey, there's a problem. But until then, hey, there's no problem. We have a lot of work to do. It's been 50 years since man landed on the moon. And I did a little digging, and I came to find out way back in 2004, Americans between 18 and 24-year-olds, 27% of them expressed doubt that NASA ever went to the moon. Now, this is quite a while ago, and as our population increases and as belief gets handed down and people talk about things, that has remained about the same. So roughly between 20 and 30% of Americans, this is just on our shores, feel that it's possible that the moon landing, you know, never happened. That Buzz Aldrin saluting the flag and all that kind of thing, it was just all filmed here on the planet. You know, it's a Steven Spielberg production. So on one hand, see, I got two hands here on my left hand. On one hand, I don't even want to talk about that, but I have to. Because on the other hand, if you don't address some of this stuff, it doesn't change anybody's mind out there, but it definitely solidifies a position. And at some point in life, that's pretty much all you can get. So when you have a percentage of people who deny something, it's a very interesting, there's a payoff in denial, no matter what that denial is. When you're denying something, there's a payoff inside there. Like you get to be part of a group. There's a bunch of people, obviously. I believe the current president said that climate change is a hoax that was invented by the Chinese people because they got nothing else to do. And so when you have a group of people who can bind together over something, even if it's not a good thing, then they have purpose. That's what gangs are about, Nazis, a couple other things come to mind. And so when there's a payoff in anything, negative or positive, people tend to clump into that. And you will find, because of the confirmation bias, you will find what you need to confirm or deny whatever it is that this is all about. So with a percentage of people denying that the moon, you know, that man ever walked on the moon, it reminds me of like the Flat Earth Society, who says that the Earth is flat. And yet on their own webpage, it says we have, you know, members of the Flat Earth Society all around the globe. Globes are round. Anyway, I digress. So some of this stuff, you will always have one in whatever. Whenever there's a TV commercial comes up and it's for some horrible disease that humans have, one in five people have gingivitis. There's always going to be one. So if five people are asked, did man land on the moon in 1969? Is that Buzz Aldrin's footprint? Four will say, yep. And one will go, nah, I don't think so. There's always going to be one. So either you spend time with the one and argue with them, which will never, ever work. Part of the payoff is they get to engage in something and have power over stuff that they normally wouldn't have power over. I think that's a lot of the allure of Facebook. You know, people that can say something to someone else they'd never say to them face to face. And so they have that sense of power. So whatever that is, it gives them that that platform, so to speak. So the reason I bring this up is because I was 10 years old when that broadcast happened on July 20th of 1969. And if you'd like to, I'm going to direct you to YouTube, which really should be called MeTube, isn't it? It's all about me. How is it about me? It isn't about YouTube. It's about MeTube. Anyway, there is a YouTube video there. I spoke at NASA at Langley Air Force Base in 2009, so 10 years ago. And I was so nervous and yet so thrilled because I had an opportunity to talk about the moon landing in July 20th of 1969. I was 10, as I mentioned. And so to be in the room at the very first TEDx NASA, which has become this, and rightfully so, incredibly prominent TED platform to be on. I was with a great group of people in that first outing. With all, you know, I don't know, 3,000 of the smartest humans on the planet in the audience, I didn't know what to talk about because I am not, at times, listen, My best grades in school were lunch and gym. Admit it. I am not a NASA scientist, so what am I going to tell these people who are sitting here in front of me? So what I talked about, and you can obviously jump over at some point, look on YouTube, and then come back. I talked about what it was like, the experience was like for me, and how that felt for me, and the process that we went through as a species to make that happen, because it happened, despite the 1 in 5 who's got gingivitis. And the thing that was most profound to me was a comment that my uncle, Frank LaJoy, who was a 5'0" Italian fella and had married my grandmother's sister, Margaret. So he was Uncle Frank LaJoy, 5 foot tall. His earlobes were about 1.5 feet long. I'll never forget it. I got a picture of him in the other room. And we were all sitting. They were playing poker at our house on Berto Avenue in Chicago on that night. It was very hot. And Ron Santo went 4 for 4 that day against the Phillies, and it was a great day for me because I'm a huge Cubs fan. And Uncle Frank LaJoy was sitting there at the table when this all was taking place. They did some simulation, and then, of course, you got to see the actual footage of the moon landing, the lunar surface. So here's a guy from, you know, was born in the 1800s, and this is 1969, and I don't think he ever looked young. He was always old, as I remember him. And when that took place, my Uncle Frank LaJoy, who, after coming from Italy with his parents, like on the boat, and never went outside of the limits of the city of Chicago that I know of, said, "Oh my gosh, look what we've done." I never forgot his words, because collectively, he felt a part of what happened, you know, 240,000 miles away. That's incredibly powerful. Because he felt like he helped in some way, shape, or form just by being around at that time, that he was able to witness something that we had never done as a species, ever. It was huge. You know, screw all the reality shows and the ways we get distracted now. This was the ultimate reality show for us in 1969. A man, actually a couple of them, walked on the lunar surface. It was incredible. And as a 10-year-old boy, I thought this was just, besides Ron Santo going 4 for 4, this was just the thing. And the other night, of course, this whole week, there's been a lot of reviewing about the 50 years and all that went along with it. And what Uncle Frank LaJoy said about look what we did was not just for him alone. There was this overwhelming feeling that everybody who was alive at that time had a little part of that. That is a rare thing these days, collected and unified in something far bigger and far greater than us. You couldn't pull that off now. You couldn't pull it off. I think that's in part why that has gone by the wayside. It is no longer Buck Rogers. It's just, who cares? There's too much else going on. Big deal. We already did that. This was the only time I had to like submit, this is what I'm going to do. I had 7 minutes to make some sort of profound impact statement, what have you. It's where radio came into play. No editing, everything's live, I got a timer, and I was used to working against a clock, so that was good. But I wanted to put in some of the footage from the lunar landing, and I had to go through a lot of hoops to get that done, but they finally saw the value in it, and they granted it. It was just a high point. I've done 2 TED Talks, and they're both great and wonderful, terrific, honored to do them, but there was nothing like standing on that stage at Langley in 2009, talking what it was like to be a 10-year-old boy and watch a man step on the moon. That was just really, really something. You know, you have to break a lot of laws. You have to break the law of gravity in order just to get to the moon. And there are certain laws that are intact. Nobody argues if there's gravity. You ever heard anybody arguing whether the law of gravity is real or not? There's some gravity deniers out there. Where are they? Well, they're floating up in the sky. But there are certain laws that transcend whether we think they are real or not. And Newton's third law, the Fig Newton guy, Sir Isaac Newton, his third law says, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And if that's not karma, I don't know what is. For every action, every single action, in the universe as we know it, there is an equal and opposite reaction. You push here, it pulls here. You pull here, it pushes here. You go up here, it goes down here. You go down here, it goes up here. You go in here, it comes out over here. You go out over here, it comes in over there. We are not immune from this. We're not exempt from this. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And the concept of karma is really referring to a very spiritual principle that originated in India. And it's based on cause and effect, where intent and action of an individual is the cause and influence the future of that individual, which then becomes the effect. So you have to really watch what you put out into the world, because some way, shape, or form, Newton's third law, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, goes into play. What you put out comes back. These days, what allows me to step back a little bit and look at history and say, we've done this before. Not even as a single society, but as a species. This is something we continually do over and over again. We push and pull. We go up and down. We go in and out. Apparently, we don't ever get tired of it. So karmically, when you think about all the things that we're doing, even what I'm doing right now, I'm choosing my words very carefully. Because I understand that all of us, every single person on this planet, is a product of the belief systems they grew up with. Every one of us. I was very fortunate to have influences in my life that said, here, let's try this way and let's not go over this way. There are people that said, I don't want to go this way. I'm just going to do this. So every headline that is difficult, challenging, overwhelming, sad, that is all based on somebody's actions based on their belief system. And they acted on what they believe to be true for them. It may not work out well for them or the persons that they're involved with. But that's how it works. The guy that went in and shot up a church was working off a belief system somebody gave him. He wrapped himself around that. He became that, which then leads me into this book that I have by James Allen called As a Man Thinketh. Because it's all tied together to me. It is all tied together in thought and in energy and action and deed. At some point, when JFK said, we're going to go to the moon in this decade, the fuse was lit. And that's what people thought about. The right people at the right time in the right way for the right reasons went along about their business. They had to think about it. They had to talk about it. And eventually, we all watched it. That thought, word, deed process shows itself in every aspect of life. Every aspect of life. Every single aspect of life. Everything in my office that's man-made, or made by humans, I don't want to just say men do it, because they don't, was a thought first. This desk, this laptop for sure, this Zoom machine, I don't know who thought this up, but somebody first had to have the thought, then they had to have to talk about it and design it, and eventually here it is sitting here. It manifests itself. So who do we think we are to believe that we're somehow exempt from those laws? Everything you think about, you become, eventually. And that's why it's so difficult to be outside of yourself for so long in unsocial media, because you get pulled into these rabbit holes where we don't belong. I this morning was watching guys argue over something that's not even true. They're arguing over it. It's friggin' hilarious and sad at the same time. James Allen published this book in 1903. And he described it this way, quote, dealing with the power of thought, and particularly with the use and application of thought to happy and beautiful issues, I have tried to make the book simple so that all can easily grasp and follow its teaching and put into practice the methods which it advises. It shows how each of us in our own thought world holds the key to every condition, good or bad, that enters in his life, and that by working patiently and intelligently upon his thoughts, he may remake his life. It was one of the first pocketbooks. It was small. It was a pocket companion for thoughtful people. And it took off. And you could buy one now for $3.97. And what do? I need a life coach for $2,500. The title of the book is influenced by a verse in the Bible from the book of Proverbs, chapter 23, verse 7. It says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he, end quote. That's it. It all begins and ends there for me. So whatever we see in the headlines from whoever it is, whether it's the President of the United States or the Pope, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Now, there are a lot of variables that go into play. It's just politics. I don't know if we can get away with it anymore. It's just religion. Really? Is that how you're going to pass it off? You need a private jet to fly around the world while people are starving in the city that you have your church? There is a lot of gray areas here. Life has never been black and white. We like to think that. It's much easier on Mayberry when Andy Griffith has an answer and it's answered in 22 minutes. I kind of like it too. But life's not like that. And there comes great difficulty in trying to apply a black and white mentality, a this or that mentality of living in the world when we live in a this and that world. It's all of it. The more we try to slice and dice it, the messier it gets. Well, it should fit in this compartment. We shouldn't have these people over here. It should be. It's always been that way. We're the ones that are resisting what is to try and make it fit what we think what was. So this little book, and I got a few more here. It's all I need. I pick up a couple pieces there. I'm working on my third book myself. They're all part and parcel of the same thing. And I find that fascinating. How is it possible that in the 21st century that we have access to untold amount of information that my parents, grandparents, for sure my great-grandparents, would boggle their mind? They wouldn't even be able to comprehend. I was just on the phone with Trudy Groning. Trudy Groning's 90 years old. And I first met her 2 years ago. There's actually a podcast with her. If you're someone coming late to the Life 2.0 podcast, scroll back middle of last year in 2018, and there's a podcast I did with Trudy. I met her 2 years ago. She had started writing a book in 1967 about what it was like to grow up in Munich, Germany, under Hitler rule as a German citizen, as a young girl, what it was like to battle multiple sclerosis for 50 years. I mean, an incredible life this woman has lived. And when I met her, after 50 years, she'd only written 44 pages. It was put in fiction form because her life was so painful, she couldn't write in first person. She needed to create characters to tell her story. I hemmed and hawed. Can I even help her do this? Had a couple conversations with people whose opinion I trust, and I was able to move forward and help her out. And it took us a year and a half to get the thing done. And it 89 at the time, she became a first-time author. She'll probably never write another book unless she lives to be 147, which could happen because she's pretty tough. But the point is, 50 years it took for that book to get finished. And now the book is out, and it's been out. And if you're a listener of this podcast, you might want to go read it. It's called A Matter of Grace by Trudy Groning. The best place to find it is on Lulu, L-U-L-U Publishing. And there's an ebook there, and that's what I wanted to kind of get to. I was able to talk with her to do an ebook version. And in her mind, she could not understand how you could read a book without having a cover. It did not add up. It did not compute. It doesn't. That's not a book. Well, technically, no, and technically, yes, because technically, technology has changed. I was just on the phone with her today explaining the ebook is out, and people who don't go to libraries or to a brick-and-mortar bookstore can buy it and download it through the magic of the universe, through unseen cables, and have her book on their phone, their Kindle, whatever it may be, iPad, without physically buying a book, putting it on a shelf. It just I'll trust you on that. Well, it's real. It's really there. So that's what I'm getting at, is how we could have all this information and still be struggling as much as we do as a species. It's fascinating to me. It's if there was one thing that really fascinated me, it'd be that. So here's a guy that writes a book in 1903, and he basically says, all you need to know is that how you think in your heart and what you focus on the longest is who you become and what is the strongest. That's it. You can put all the rest away. That right there is enough to keep people busy most of their lives, because we have to untangle this unbelievable spider webs of beliefs we grew up with, were handed to us, what society tells us. And, you know, there's another podcast you should listen to that I did. It's called with Kristen Piccellini. This is a guy that's a former neo-Nazi skinhead son of a bitch. And now he's not. He was able to undo that spider web. And now what does he do? He spends his days helping other people change their belief systems and not hate other people simply by the color of their skin or their religion. This is what he spends his time on. But he wouldn't be able to do it if he hadn't had the other experience first. So there's purpose in our pain. Sometimes our biggest pain becomes our greatest purpose. So in all of what I'm talking about today, I was trying to keep it light as possible, but I'm just, you know, these things pop up and it's like, this is all going on. And you have to step back at some point and say this. Whatever you feed stays alive. What you don't feed dies. You don't feed your pet, it eventually dies. You don't feed a relationship, it eventually dies. You don't feed your bank account, it'll dry up. They'll come get you. What you feed stays alive. What you don't feed dies. Pretty simple stuff, but not easy to do. Because we have all these challenges. What do I feed? What don't I feed? How much do I feed it? Am I on a diet? Do I pull back here? Do I push here? And when you take everything into consideration, that what you put out comes back, we have to have discernment in what we feed and what we don't, how difficult it is and how easy it is. And I think that's another big challenge for people. You know, we, for the most part, you grow up thinking the world's one way, and then you realize, well, maybe it's not exactly like I thought, even though I don't change my view of the world. Maybe it's important the world doesn't change me. They have some optimism that even in the midst of all this difficulty, there's still a possibility that there's a lot of good going on in the world, even though it doesn't show up on CNN or Fox or MSNBC or CBS or whatever your spigot of choice is, that life is still worth living. That's still a good thing to be alive. So one of the things Trudy said to me at 90, I said, how are you doing? She says, every day that I'm still upright is a good day. This is a woman who lived through the Holocaust as a German citizen, lost friends to the gas chambers. She's 90. She's living history. And she's telling me, every day above ground's a good day, John. She's the only one left in her family besides her son. Whatever you feed stays alive. Fear, guilt, shame, anger, anxiety, depression. Whatever you feed stays alive. What you don't feed will die. You start starving things that aren't good for you, they will go away and stop. It takes a lot of work, takes a lot of effort. More importantly, takes conscious and choice. Choices and chances make the difference. So you might be saying at this point, hey, John, why do you keep a dead cicada in your office? What's the point of that? I knew you were going to ask at some point, so let me just get to it. I am fascinated by cicadas for various reasons. But the main reason is, and it goes back to some of the stuff I was talking about before, they've basically been around for about 400 million years in some way, shape, or form. Humans, about 100,000 years. Cicadas, 400 million years. And it's getting hot in the middle of summer, go figure, here in Chicago. And at night, I can hear the cicadas. And a lot of people, I hate those goddamn cicadas. They've been here 400 million years. They don't care whether you like them or not. They are nothing more, in my opinion, an observation of what I read. They're nothing more than a food source for birds and fish and things like that. They play a very, very vital role in the ecosystem. So how would you like to, you know, be stuffed underground for 17 years, depending on the species, and then you only live for about 5 or 6 weeks? That's a bugger, no pun intended. 17 years underground, then you come out, and then the shells are laying all over the place, and people are like, what's that? I'm like, that's a cicada. They're very cool. And I should do a podcast called The Cicada Diaries, because I'm telling you, they're the most fascinating ancient beast to me ever. I mean, the alligator in Humboldt Park's pretty cool. They've been around a long time as well. But a cicada? I mean, the one I have in my office, he's like right over here. I haven't named him. I probably should. Like Charlie the Cicada? I don't know. But he's in perfect condition. When he expired on this brick outside, all the life force left him, all the little juices dried up. and he is this perfect cicada. And this cicada, from what I looked up, went underground 17 years ago. So that means he had been under the ground since 2002. This is as of last summer, so 2001. And that was it. 17 years since 2001, comes out for 5 or 6 weeks, rubs his wings together, has some sex, and then dies. Maybe not a bad existence after all. Anyway, I'm fascinated by these creatures because once again, it reminds me we are not the only species on the planet that matters. These incredible insects, 400 million years, a vital part, kind of like a feeder species for so many other species. You know, when they start dropping off, they are like canary in the cage. When certain species has difficulty, mostly because of human interference, it always affects something else. Oh, we're back to the third law. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And finally, this, I want to end up on a high note. I tend to say things, we all do this. We'll say things like, you know, I read somebody the Riot Act. Have you actually read the Riot Act? You ever see what's in the Riot Act? We come up with these catchphrases, and I happen to say kit and caboodle when I did the open of the show some 40 minutes ago. I don't know what a kit and caboodle is. Do you know what a kit and caboodle is? So I looked it up. The meaning of the phrase, the whole kit and caboodle, is a collection of things. The origin of the phrase, a kit is a set of objects like a toolkit or what a soldier might put in his kit bag. A caboodle or boodle is an archaic term meaning group or collection, usually a lot of people. There are several phrases similar to the whole kit and caboodle, which is first recorded in that form in 1884. Most of them are of U.S. origin, of course, because we do everything, right? And all the early citations are American. Caboodle was never in common use outside the USA and now has died out everywhere else in the world except right here. The whole kit, a whole of a soldier's necessities and contents of his knapsack, from the Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue in 1785. The whole kit. The Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue. Kind of like that. The whole kit and caboodle was actually written as the whole kit and boodle. This citation is slightly later than that of the whole kit and caboodle, which we know now. It's worth including as it gives a 19th century version of the meaning of the term. So the bottom line is this. For better or for worse, we did a little digging for the obvious truth buried in the absurd. We went up the down staircase. We went in the outdoor. Tried to make sense of the senseless on the Life 2.0 podcast. So I appreciate your time. And just remember, as we wrap this up, a couple things. Be good to the cicadas, because Newton's third law is always working. What goes around, comes around. Safe travels. Adios.